welcome to our new Mick Artistics Ego podcast. We'll be bringing you chat, insight, nonsense, laughter, music, and a few surprises. You can find out about our current activities, gigs, release news at mickartistic.com and on Facebook at Mick Artistics Ego Trip, as well as plenty of footage on our YouTube channel. And you can follow us on Twitter at Mick Artistic and at Johnny Ego Trip and at Ego Trip News. And our guest today is Vic Goddard. He's a musician, a painter. He's been a postman for 30 years. He's a football fan and described by Mark Riley as the greatest living Englishman. Toured with The Clash, and he's been a member of the Subway Sect on and off for the last 40 years. And in today's podcast, we'll be talking about FC United, the problem with drummers, touring with The Clash, Johnny Thunder's lack of material, being a postman for 30 years and his love of drains. And I end up playing table tennis with him in his backyard for about an hour. Hello, Vic.
Hello, Mick. Nice to have you around in the garage.
It's nice to be here with a cup of tea. There's two cups of tea.
What's the name of James Dutton's single? Control. I've got terrible
good health. Jink. He's got a Man United shirt on as well, but I'm still going to talk to
him. It's not Man United. Hey, man, you haven't read it properly.
Football Club of Manchester.
It's FC United.
They're FC.
They're in a plastic. Or what's it called? They're all sponsored by glues, aren't they? All the lower league.
This is the little side that's not kind of loaded and have got people like Paul Pogba in it. It's just this is the Salford.
Yeah,
it's set in, they've got a ground in Salford.
They're a division under.
Yeah,
Salford a bit. I think Salford have got a bit more money. Oh. I used to play in Bury's ground, but the council have built them their own ground now. 5,000 stadium.
Because they had like sort of a, was it a green and
no, that's, green, that's green and Newton gold. Heath. That's the original Man United was called Newton Heath.
Yeah,
but didn't green and gold stripes. But this lot's nothing to do with them. This is a group that when the Glazers took over.
Yeah, no, I know.
They started this FC United.
But what's this? What's the football kit? Haven't they got like sort of, it's not like red and white. It's not the Red Devils. It's like they've got like a. I think it's like green and white or green and yellow or something, isn't it?
Maybe. No, I thought it was red and white because this is the away shirt. So I assumed it would be. I think
they've got like sort of it's like green and yellow or something.
But you know when the green and yellow thing started, remember all the Man United fans, they weren't happy, were they? And they started turning up to the matches in green and yellow stripes. Do you remember that? That was when the Glazers took over, wasn't it?
Yeah.
They went back to the original club called Newton Heath, and that was their colours. But the trouble is, when they played Norwich, everyone thought that it was all Norwich fans.
So are you a football fan then?
Not really. I only watch Chelsea. My dad is obsessed by football. He loves women's football especially, but any football match he'll watch. Whereas he's like an Arsenal fan.
I'm the same. I only watch
Chelsea. I'm not really interested in other football matches. I've always been like that.
Do you go to see them then? Do you go to the ground?
No, I haven't been for ages. I mean, Paul is a season ticket holder.
Cool. All right.
So sometimes he's taken me some great matches where his mates haven't been able to make it at the last minute. I went to the one against Barcelona when they had Ronaldinho playing for them. Brilliant, but with Ronaldinho, Messi and all that. Seeing all that lot in the flesh was absolutely fair. They murdered Chelsea.
Yeah.
And
Chelsea lost a couple of weeks ago, didn't they?
Yeah.
Was it against?
Bayern Munich, 7-1. Mind you, the next match, Bayern Munich, they beat Barcelona 8-2, didn't they? Didn't feel so bad then. But no, I've always been a Chelsea fan ever since my uncle was a massive Chelsea fan. First ground I went to though was Tottenham, because my granddad, he drove out of Mortlake Garage buses, and they had a number 9 which went to Aldwych from Mortlake Garage, but they also had a 73 which went to Stoke Newington. And he was a Tottenham fan because he used to go to Stoke Newington and then get one more bus right outside Tottenham's garage. So he got all his bus free, you know. And so the first few games I went to as a little tiny kid was at Tottenham. That was absolutely amazing because...
So who did you see? Who would have been there?
Alan Gilzean and Jimmy Greaves up front. It was like basically Dave McKay, all the famous double winners.
Was Blanchflower.
Danny Blanchflower had gone by then.
Yeah.
But the best thing was we went up the... Park Lane end, which was always where the top, we went at the other end, the away end, the Paxton Road end, right behind the goal.
Yeah.
And every home match, we were standing right, you know who else used to go in that position? Peter Cook. He was a mad Tottenham fan. And he had a bottle of whiskey with him every match at night. So he got more and more pissed as the match, and he was coming out of some hilarious things, you know. And my granddad was quite a sort of witty bloke, so he was sort of joining with a banter. It was
fantastic. Oh, there's some classic stuff. Yeah. My son texts me to see Leeds every now and again. And I used to go, my dad used to take me when I was a kid to Allen Road. And I kind of stopped when kind of punk started and when I got to like 15, 16.
Yeah, I
16.
Did that. I went right off.
Yeah, because football became really uncool.
Irrelevant.
Yeah, it was because like, music was all about sex and looking good. And footballers just didn't look good about 1975. Leeds were particularly unattractive physically. Yeah. There was some pretty, you know, Man United had Best and Law and a few, and Spurs had some pretty players, I remember. But but it was the music that, and now my son is a, he's an avid Leeds United fan, and he's followed them from when they were like really low.
Yeah.
And he's 30, but he's seen them through some dark times, and he's always had his Leeds shirt on, even when he was living in Ipswich with his mum when we split up.
Yeah.
And he's completely, he's besotted here. So he comes up to Leeds and he takes me to a match every now and again. And I'm always, basically, I'm choking with some of the songs that come out from around me. Some of the language, some of the wit.
Yeah,
it's just oh man, I'm just thinking that should be a hit.
Yeah,
because there's so much wit and so much kind of intelligence that floating around a football ground.
That's right.
You know, these little snippets that fly out and the timing.
Yeah.
You know, and
another game I went to that I'll never forget is do you remember that game when Chelsea played City at home and Wayne Bridge had to shake hands with
Chelsea. Oh, yeah.
Well, I was sitting right above where they were. Fantastic.
Yeah,
and City, you know, what I remember about that game was in Bellamy was playing for City and Chelsea were winning, I think, like 3-1. And it looked like they were coasting. And then second half, something happened to Bellamy. I've never seen, he was like possessed.
Oh, yeah.
I think someone might have tackled him and the ref didn't give it to him. And from then on, the bloke was like everywhere. And like, I think they either won or they got a draw. They might have even won, but I think that was the game when
Bridges got
was it
even.
He
got,
or
yeah, it was, as far as I remember.
Game.
Yeah.
But that, I've never seen a player so outstanding in a half of a match as Craig Bellamy.
Yeah.
Bloke was absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, but he kind of operated in a sort of like, you know, he was quite volatile. And his game was about kind
he's
of
like a ball terrier, and, weren't he?
Yeah.
He's like a ball terrier.
Yeah.
And he's so meaty as well, so strong, you couldn't get him off the ball.
I just wonder, did he end
and
up at
was
Leeds?
Really fast.
Did he end up at Leeds, Craig Bellamy?
I don't know, but he was so fast off us, you know, standing start.
Hey, well, it was, you know, very, very charismatic.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you'd see him on the screen, you know, you get a close up.
Yeah. See, it really mattered.
Giving somebody the eye or something, you know, on the pitch. Oh. Now, we saw each other last year at Port Elliot.
Yeah. It doesn't seem like.
Oh,
year,
my God.
Does it? It seems like a lot longer than that.
Yeah.
I thought
it was
two
another
years
era.
Ago.
It was in the era of.
I actually thought that was 2 years ago, you know.
No, that was last year.
It's like an era of innocence, isn't it, now? It's like really weird.
This is limbo, whatever it is.
Yeah.
But we. Did you play? Did you play?
Yeah.
The Black Cow, was it?
Yeah.
Because I'd heard and I would have. I think we were probably playing that evening.
My album, I recreate the last songs. In the last song, I had these vinyl albums. I didn't want to take them home. So I said, oh, I'm going to have a quiz to give away this album. And my question was, who was the original presenter of Mr. and Mrs.? Because I knew, you know, loads of people say Derek Beatty, but it wasn't Derek Beatty. He was the second presenter. Anyway, so, but the trouble is, when you have a quiz at a gig, you can't do it because people just go and Google it, don't they? Anyway, this bloke...
Oh, I suppose, yeah.
Yeah, you have to just, like, somehow...
You have to have a raffle. Phones. No, you don't do a quiz, you do a raffle.
We do raffles. We used to do raffles, yeah. I've done raffles loads of times. But the trouble is, the funny thing about what I love about the raffles we used to do is I used to get different members of the group to pull out the tickets. And you'd just be there for ages, and no one would have the winning ticket.
Yeah.
And like, and all the
empty silence. Yeah. You know, you're thinking, but 4, 5, 3.
But the thing is, like, you'd have the drummer saying, look, we've only got 45 minutes set. We've already wasted 10 minutes. We're on a fucking raffle. You know, they're getting all, drummers always want to get going. They don't want to just sit there and watch what's going on.
Luckily, we don't have a drummer, so we don't.
Well, the thing is, if you sort of tell jokes, have raffles and all that, they just don't like sitting behind. They should just relax, sit behind the drums and listen, you know, or join in, you know. But drummers are really, I just want to.
No. We had a drummer for about 3-4 weeks, Vic, and he got bored because he was a great funky drummer, a bit like, you know, the guy out of the Blockheads. And just a little Scottish guy, fantastic. But our stuff is very, very straight down the line. There's no kind of, it doesn't take any deviations. It's fairly sort of it's, you know, quite punky.
Yeah.
And a little bit funky, but right at the start, there was more kind of music hall, kind of straight down. And he got bored, so he left. So we ended up with he ditched the band about two nights before a gig, and then it was just me and the guitar player and the bass player. We're thinking, oh well, what can we do? And I thought, well, I'll just do the percussion because I'll let the words be the drum, be the beat, and then afterwards we got a little Casio little drum machine, like LCD sound system. Well,
yeah,
and I found it in a charity shop. Pressed the button, plugged it in.
It's great.
That's it. There's no issues. There's no musical differences. You've just got a fucking machine there.
Metal Urban.
Didn't
they used to do sort of like real rough punk, but over a drum machine instead of a drummer?
I don't know. I haven't heard the name for years.
They were the first record on Rough Trade. Rough Trade 001 is them, I think. But they were really good, but they seem to disappear really quickly.
Well, I've not heard them until you mentioned them, you know.
They're the first group I remember that was punky that had a drum machine. That's why, because that was like 76, that was. I don't know if they had drum machines in 76, so that must have been the very primitive first one.
I think Yamaha used to have like little drum machines, but they'd only have about maybe 6 beats.
Yeah.
So you'd get samba,
you'd
get country, you'd get rock.
The rock one at all different tempos.
Military beats.
I love drum machines. I love programming drum machines. I haven't done it for about 20 years, but in the 90s, I spent about 10 years gradually getting better and better. And I always wanted to achieve something on the drum machine that I thought was totally impossible, because my drum machine ain't a modern one. It's a thing called a Roland something. It's like one of them ones about... It's like the same size as that bit of wood, actually, or a bit bigger. Do you know the one? Slim...
Yeah. I don't
Roland
know.
Something or other. Uh-huh. They used to be called Boss, and then Roland took over Boss.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't change Boss's drum machine. They just made it a little bit bigger. But the thing is, you know, drum machines ain't got syncopation. And they, like you say, I'm really into Jimmy Reed, you know, the blues man. Have you heard his drummer?
No, I haven't.
It's fantastic. It's really like... Really simple, but with tons of feel. Like, you always feel like he's not quite in time, but he is, you know, because Jimmy Reed's music is very laid back, isn't it?
I know the name, but I couldn't...
Big bright lights, big city.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Went to my baby's head. Ooh, the bright light. Yeah. Big city. And then big boss man, don't you hear me when I call?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Big boss man. And, well, Stones used to do, and Honest I Do. Don't you know that I love you? Honest I do. Honest. No, that one Stones did. They did a lot of Jimmy Reed.
I mean, I know Big Boss Man and the Bright Lights and Big City.
Yeah.
Because that was it Charlie Sheen?
Shame, Shame, Shame. Do you know that one? Oh, ain't that a shame, shame, shame.
Yeah.
Oh, it's a shame on you. It's a shame, shame,
That's Jimmy Reed.
They're all Jimmy Reed, all those songs I've just done. Yeah. See, he was like, about him, the Rolling Stones. Well, without him, Chuck Berry and Bo Diddley. Those three, there wouldn't be a Rolling Stones or any of those R&B girl, Pretty Things, Yardbirds. And we had a bloke who lived just over the railway, Keith Relf. Have you heard of him?
Yeah, he sang with the young, pretty man.
Sandringham Road, just over the road there.
Yeah.
I think, is he
still alive, Keith?
He got electrocuted in the '70s, I think.
Oh God, yeah.
And he looked exactly like Brian Jones, didn't he?
Yeah, he was very pretty. I remember as a little kid seeing him on telly, thinking, "Oh my gosh, he's like a superhero."
Yeah.
And this lovely like page
for
voice.
For your love, that's a great song, isn't it? I'll give you everything and more, that's for sure. For your love,
that's some great stuff.
The Yardbirds. See, that was all round this area. See, that whole scene was Richmond, wasn't it?
All right.
Yeah, Rolling Stones started off in Richmond at the Station Hotel. Just down the road in Ealing, they had a blues club, I think, where Townsend used to go down. Mm. All that lot all knew each other.
Is Eel Pie Island down here?
Yeah, it's Twickenham, which is about a mile after Richmond in the river. Okay. So, my sister used to go there.
Because they're all like Graham Bond played down here, and Jack Bruce and Ginger Baker and... And
everyone in the music scene.
Hextall Smith and all these people. Yeah, because I remember reading.
You know. My manager, Bernie Rhodes, he was flatmate of Graham Bond.
Yeah.
He chucked himself on an underground train, I think, in the 60s.
Because he was.
But loads of great musicians came out of his group, wasn't it? Graham Bond Organisation, it was called.
Yeah,
I think
Alexis Corner as well.
Yeah.
Alexis Corner and people like that. Yeah.
But that was all round this area. So my sister, who's like 9 years older than me, she used to take me to this place called La Berge in Richmond, where all people like Jagger and that used to hang out in there. So when I was a little kid, I was like in these places with all these, I didn't know art or work, but she would tell me who they were. And Long John Baldry, he was like,
so it'd be Rod Stewart would be playing as well, wouldn't he?
Yeah, she never saw him, but she remembers Long John Baldry really well because she was just
he was
really
an amazing
polite
voice.
Man, a great singer, but great such voice. A polite man.
Yeah,
And he was really tall, you know. He's like dominated the scene. He always had pristine clothes. She said he was the best dressed bloke there, Long John Baldry.
I can remember him on television. I can remember seeing him on like Ready, Steady, Go, maybe, when I was a kid. I mean, reading about all that stuff about Richmond, you know, there's countless books and magazine articles and stuff that I used to soak up as a kid and talk about.
Faces was another one. There used to be these railway sidings down the road on the approach to Richmond Station between North Sheen and Richmond. North Sheen is right at the end of this road. So
North Sheen. Oh, yeah.
It's right at the station before Richmond. So in between there and Richmond, there's all these railway sidings with old shunting stuff. And it had a big yard, and there was all these old buses and coaches just derelict in this yard all the way through the 60s. Well, the Small Faces had one of them, you know, before they became the Faces.
Yeah.
They all lived in one of those, in the summer, in this bus, in the sidings. And that must be where they bumped into Rod Stewart, because he was, you know, with Long John Baldry playing locally.
Yeah.
So that's obviously how they bumped into each other and became the Faces. Because they've actually got a song called Richmond, didn't they? The Faces.
Don't know.
Yeah, yeah, it's really good. Ronnie Lane's song, Richmond.
Oh, Ronnie Lane, yeah.
Yeah, because they were all from the East End, see? The Small Faces, Ronnie Lane, McLagan, Steve Marriott, and who's the other one you got?
Kenny Jones.
Kenny Jones, yeah, all the East End.
All these, they got the name because this girl said, oh, you're all small faces,
And they were all, the face meant you were like the top model with all the best clothes, so they were like that, you know, they all had all the best American gear on and all that.
Yeah.
And I suppose so did Rod Stewart, so they all...
No, they were very well dressed, and Rod Stewart dressed amazingly for quite a while until he fell off the whatever.
Yeah, they got a great song, Richmond. It's like a real slow sort of folk thing with slide guitars, really nice.
Yeah, Ronnie Lane did some very sort of lyrical sort of, How Come?
Yeah,
How Come?
Fantastic.
How Come?
Yeah.
I ain't superstitious.
Brilliant. I tell you who else was around at that time. Do you remember Andy Fairweather Lowe's solo album? What was the one?
Spider Jagger.
Legless, yeah. I kind of done it again.
Yeah.
Oh, that was fantastic because I think Ronnie Lane might have played with him. I went to see him at the Roundhouse Fairweather Lowe, and I think Ronnie Lane came on and did some numbers with him.
Yeah. I loved him. I had a couple of his albums, and I remember him when he was in that Amen Corner.
I loved Amen Corner, and he just had this voice.
Amazing delivery. It was so kind of sleepy,
easy,
somnambulistic.
It's like making it sound like it's the easiest thing in the world.
It just sounded like Milkshake.
Yeah. Wonderful singer. He was,
and an amazing guitarist. He was like, I didn't realise that because he was playing guitar with Eric Clapton for like 14 years or something, and as sort of his second guitarist, and he just kind of subsumed himself and became this musician. But I saw him play at I think it might have been Latitude, and he came on and he looked like, basically looked like a managing director. He's basically had these steel rimmed glasses, bald head,
he had the voice,
but he had this suit on and he looked like Lee Marvin. He looked like a killer. he came on and he was quite fierce, and then he got into but the songs, you know, just beautiful, wonderful stuff. And I think he shared the bill with, it was like a thing where it was like Andy Fairweather Lowe and Nick Lowe, both did like kind of like half an hour each on this stage. They were doing a kind of a double act.
Nice.
Did you sort of go and see people like Brinsley Schwartz and Dr.
No.
Feelgood?
Dr. Feelgood? Yeah. I mean, I haven't really...
Well, you've always grown up round here then? Has this been your sort of...
Well, not Kew. I'm from Farns, which is about 2 miles down the road. I've always been in this borough. I've never really left it, really, except when going on tours.
Yeah. And so you got up to Leeds, didn't you, back? I remember because I think I saw you with a Clash, because I was... It was like, I'm not sure, the White Rights, was it?
Yeah.
But I remember there was a kind of just this fucking avalanche or this invasion of like from the south of all you, like you came up and we didn't have anybody in Leeds, really.
No.
You know, you had like sort of the Vibrators and the Stranglers and Tom Robinson Band and bloody and Clash and Pistols and God knows how many, you know, the Upstarts and... you know, the whatever Nicky Tesco and all that crowd, and we had nothing, and so you lot just came up and just do your business and head back down again. So what was it like coming up north? What was it like playing to sort of, you know, to northern audiences? You know,
in the punk era?
Yeah, coming up to Leeds, it's just a gig.
It didn't really make any difference to us who the audience was. I mean, the first audiences we had were French, which was weird. The first 3 dates were in France. So
This was the white riot tour. And the, to France,
the first English date, I think, was in Guildford.
Yeah.
And I think we were in Scotland.
Yeah, because Edwin Collins was there.
I don't remember much about that. Oh. All about the actual gigs, I don't really remember a lot. It's the what happened when we weren't doing the gigs that I remember. Like all the japes that were going on the way to the gigs or in the hotel after the gigs. I tend to remember them.
Would you share a bus? Would you be like in the same bus as Paul Simonon?
Yeah, we were all on the coach.
Okay. And how were they all right? Was there any kind of hierarchy thing going on there? Or were you just...
No, we were just all chances. The piss out of the coach driver. We used to play football, but, when we stopped off at a service station in the forecourts and all that sort of business. Actually, we played quite a bit of football on bits of grass anywhere, really.
Yeah.
No, we were just... because Clash hadn't been signed by a record label, I don't think, at that point. Or if they had, they weren't making their presence known until about halfway through the tour. I remember that. The record company sort of started turning up to the gigs. Ah, that was it. And I think they kicked the prefects off the tour. At some point. That was around about the same time. And they told us...
Where was that?
And they told us that we could no longer have room service from that point on. So I think the record company realised that they were paying a bill. And when they saw that they weren't just paying a bill for the Clash, but they were paying it for like prefects, subway sec, and that was all hotel-wise.
Yeah.
The prefects got slung out of the hotel as well. They had to sleep in the van from the halfway point of the tour because I think CBS said that they wouldn't pay. I don't know how we got away with it. Maybe Bernie paid for our hotel. I can't imagine it.
Because he was the manager of the Clash.
Manager as well, but he wasn't the prefect's manager. So he just told them, look, lad, sorry, but you can't have any more hotels for the rest of the tour. we had some great times in hotels.
I know you're a fan of Johnny Thunders and that singular, because I remember seeing him when they came up to Leeds, the Heartbreakers.
I saw them and
he seemed like sort of a man among boys.
Yeah.
He got up and he says, this one's called I Love You. 1, 2, 3 I thought, what a great... I love you. And he had a white... He just had a white T-shirt on. He came on in a white T-shirt. He looked like Sylvester Stallone. He was quite ripped, he was. And he was just... Yeah. And he just looked like some kind of... the Fonz, like some kind of, sort of Latino heartthrob. And just came and said, this one's called I Love You. 1, 2, 3 Amazing gig. And just had so much, so rich, so much kind of texture to what he was doing and
it's
romance.
Really exciting. Yeah. His guitar playing. The Heartbreakers were just a really exciting group to watch anyway, weren't they? Because they had two singers on a lot of the stuff, didn't they? Yeah. Johnny Thunders and Walter Lure did a lot of vocals didn't they?
Yeah,
they were good. They played London a few times.
They could play,
But they didn't have... They didn't have the material then.
Yeah.
When they first came to London, they only had
Chinese
enough for one album.
Yeah.
They didn't have enough to do a long enough set. So what they used to do, they used to come on, do the set once, go away for half an hour, and then just come back and do the same set again in exactly the same order. And they did Chinese Rocks at the first song and the last song. And then they came back and did it first and last. They did it four times in all, just to So they were so exciting, but they just didn't have enough material. Yeah. And obviously later on,
because I remember the Heartbreakers. Wasn't Richard Hell with them at the beginning?
Not in England. He was in New America. York. Yeah, I've seen a film of the stuff on YouTube of Heartbreakers with Richard. They were nothing like the Heartbreakers with him.
I'm sure.
I mean, I see him doing Blank Generation, and it's not the Heartbreakers. It's more like his backing group on that,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
Very similar to the Sex Pistols in sound, you know. Because Steve Jones, basically, he wanted to get Johnny Thunders' his guitar sound. You know, he was really... when we first went to see the Sex Pistols, that's what we thought it was, like an English version of the Dolls. Because they actually had that sound, because they didn't have that sound when they did their album. But when they were in the formative gigs, when they weren't that good, they were a lot looser. And also they had Glenn Matlock on bass, didn't they? Which made a massive difference, because he did a lot of backing vocals as well.
Yeah.
And they missed him. So when they were really ramshackle, they actually were a lot more like the New York Dolls.
Yeah. I saw them. They came up to Leeds in 76 in like October.
Yeah, well, that was more ballsy, weren't it?
It was, but it was a very short set, and they did like kind of "I'm Not Your Stepping Stone" and a Monkey song. They did a "I Can't Explain."
Never heard them do that.
Yeah, yeah.
They did. They used to do "Understanding" by the Small Faces.
They did "What You're Gonna Do." I want you to.
I hate you, baby.
They
did that. Yeah.
But Glenn Matlock, I remember seeing him. They came up to this big club called the Ford Green.
And sang "Can't Explain."
Yeah.
I can't imagine him doing that. Well, did he do it sort of like in an ironic sort of voice?
I think it was.
I can't imagine him singing that.
But I got a little cassette recording of it. I brought a tape machine with me.
You still got it?
No, I gave it gave it to me, mate. And
Did that. I had loads of Sex Pistols tapes, and I gave them all to Paul.
Yeah, well, I went.
I should have that, because it's not you. Honestly.
Well, I went into the dressing room after the gig, because I thought, I'm just going to go in and see if I can talk to them. And I walked in, and they were sitting there, and. And I just watched him. I'd seen Glenn Matlock. He'd come on stage and he had like bedroom slippers on.
Oh.
He was wearing bedroom slippers, and he had his lead wrapped around his bass lead wrapped around his leg. And I'm thinking, fucking. And Paul Cook had like sort of like maybe a pink jacket on, a fur jacket on or something. And they just did this really short set. And all the Leeds crowd sat there and they sat in silence.
Yeah.
And Ron went, "It's like playing the statues." And they just sat there. These lads, 1976, just sat there at the table and watched them. A concert room full of, you know, just Lee lads. They sat. And it was like a standoff, you know.
Oh.
And it finished. And I didn't know what was going to happen. Because I thought, nothing. There was no pogoing. It was before pogoing.
Yeah.
This was just high waisters and stuff.
Yeah.
And then it stopped. It finished. And then everybody stood up and just went, "Whoa!"
Oh.
I just went, man, it was a Sunday night. And they just, because they didn't know how to express themselves.
Yeah,
and so I went in afterwards and I just kind of walked in and said, "Oh, I'm from Crawdaddy. Would you like to say a few words?" And he said, "Yeah, back off." And then I gave it to a mate of mine, Mark Manning.
Oh, yeah.
And he never gave it back.
No. Yeah. That's exciting times, that was.
Right? Yeah, well, my mum and dad, I'm from Ireland, and my dad was a musician, he played Irish music.
Yeah.
And we came over from Ireland, from Leitrim to the rest of Ireland, over to Leeds in like 1960. And I basically ditched all the Irish stuff, because it wasn't cool. Ireland was like, fucking, it was slave nation, it was second class. So basically, me and my brothers, we just ditched our roots as little kids, because you just have to survive.
Yeah.
You know, the Irish got a lot of stick, you know, and at that point, and you know, there was like no blacks, no Irish, etc., you know.
Yeah.
And so we dropped on the whole, hey, all right, well, and got, we became mods, or whatever.
Oh.
We were left by 7, 8, 9, just we watched Top of the Pops, and we just sucked up all this stuff. and we were watching this Dave Clark Five and the Stones, yeah. and we became English.
Yeah.
We blended in. That yeah. was it. And so, yeah, just don't know where the fuck I was going with that. Where was I going with that? I was
making a point. 60s. You became English.
Oh fuck, are you? Well, I did, but I've lost my train of thought now.
You become Yorkshire.
Yeah, well, I don't know whether I suppose, but it's funny. I've my mother, she's 87 now,
yeah.
and she plays the accordion and the fiddle.
My dad used to play the accordion. I still got his accordion in there somewhere.
It's I love it. It's a lovely instrument.
You're fantastic, isn't it?
I play a little bit myself.
Pretty heavy though.
Well, it depends. You've got big piano accordions.
And
you've got melodeons, which are kind of smaller.
Yeah.
And you've got you can have a mini piano accordion, and you've got a concertina. Like, somebody gave me a concertina. Oh, my mum gave me a concertina. Right. It only plays one note. So it goes It's right. there. It's crying out for a song.
Yeah.
But now, my mum gave me an accordion when I was 60, and she and I started to play. I've been playing when I was a kid,
yeah.
And then somebody, it was the year that David Bowie died,
yeah.
and then they said, "Will you come and play there's a tribute night on? We want to sort of kind of venerate him and celebrate his passings." And I said, "Yeah, I'll come along, you know." But I wasn't particularly, I didn't have any Bowie albums, but no. I saw him as somebody who was really important for a lot of things. I mean, he was somebody who pointed the way in sort of visually and culturally. You know, he read good books, he knew the right people, he talked about Iggy Pop and Andy Warhol and Burroughs and stuff.
Yeah,
and
he was someone who let you learn, he said go that way, made you learn.
So I thought, well, I'll do him a song, but I'll do it on the accordion. And it'll just be like a folk song, and it'll just be a pile of nonsense.
Yeah.
I said, he invented the onesie,
yeah.
and he used to go watch Doncaster Rovers with his, and every time they scored a goal, he'd go wah wah wah. So I made this, and I thought, well, I'm not going to sit there doing Starman at this blooming tribute now, because he deserves a bit more than that for me.
Yeah.
So I thought, I'll just write a song. And we did this song called David Bowie Was a Funny Man.
Yeah.
And we do it, and it's...
He was. It works. He had a great sense of humour, didn't he?
He was a strange man, and a very interesting man, and a kind of a figurehead, really.
Yeah.
You know, I can remember just wanting hair like him.
Got him to autograph all my albums.
Oh, man.
By a fluke. I was walking past... I used to work at this hamburger restaurant near Olympic Studios. And I saw his chauffeur outside, who I recognised from being at the gigs. And I recognised his car as well, great big black Lincoln limousine thing, this massive American chauffeur that he used to have.
Yeah.
Saw him sitting outside. So I went up to him, I said, "Oh, is Bowie recording in there?" He said, "Yeah." He said, if you want any autographs, come back at 10 o'clock. That's when he finishes. So I went back, and at 10, the chauffeur said, "Yeah, wait." He wasn't there. He said, "Yeah, wait, he'll be out any minute." And as he came out in this fedora and a sort of full-length sort of fur-type coat, looking like a really thin looking, and he'd just been doing Rebel in there.
Oh, yeah.
So, I've got all my, about four or five albums autographed.
Yeah. I can remember just, I think because my stepdaughter, she was a fan, and she had some of his albums. Then she played them the night or two after, and I think we were taking the decorations down, I think, the Christmas decorations, because it was January, I think, that was it. And I can remember, she played Kooks, and I started to cry.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And I'm just thinking, I thought that's such an incredibly tender song. Yeah. And I never associated him sort of with tenderness. He was very kind of cool. He was very sort of, you know, unattainable. There's something quite sort of
early and special. Not like
but
that.
Some of it was
his
really
early stuff's not like that. All the 1960s
and Life on Mars and stuff. And there was and Changes is a lovely song.
But so if you go back to the '60s when he did all those sort of Anthony Newley inspired songs, there's a lot of really great tenderness on those Images album, double album it was. Fantastic stuff on that.
I was looking at some of it.
London Boys. You must know that one. That's on there.
And
it's really haunting, isn't it?
And he did some like what was it now? He did some like Jacques Brel stuff as well.
B-sides. He used to put Jacques
Amsterdam
Brel
and stuff, didn't he?
B-sides he used to do Amsterdam and My Death he did as well.
Yeah. Because I can remember I went to Bradford Art College in the '70s, I was there 74, 78, and so I was there for his Station to Station period and his Ziggy and whatever, and then his Iggy Pop stuff, and The Man Who Fell to Earth, and that
Low was like a groundbreaking album. Though I remember when that came out, Low, was right in the middle of the punk era, wasn't it?
And yeah,
never heard anything like that. I thought that is fantastic. Yeah.
Great Duffel Coat.
Yeah, and I actually did about 8 songs inspired by Low that were nothing like what I was doing at that time, but I just did them on an acoustic guitar, and I sang them into one of those old reel-to-reel players I used to have, reel-to-reel
tape.
Tamberg
or something. Yeah.
But I sold the bloody machine, didn't I?
With the songs on it. In the 80s,
with all the songs on it.
Oh, God.
It's a tragedy, that.
Yeah, because I was looking at some film in there, you were doing some Boland, you did a Boland cover in there. Is it Resonance? You did FM and you did that. Ever met a woman with a frog in around in New York City? I thought, what the hell's that? I'm thinking, because it was just, because it, and I thought, it's Boland, is that?
Yeah.
It's Mark Boland.
Yeah, because he's from round here, wasn't he? He was actually from Stoke Newington, but he lived in East Sheen, right at the bottom of the road where my school was. So I went past his house on the way to school. It's not like a very flash house, just like a normal suburban house, but it did have a high wall around it.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he died on the way back there, didn't he, on Barnes Common?
He hit a tree, didn't he? Was it in a mini or something?
I was really into bowling. I still am. I still play all the, I tend to play all the Tyrannosaurus Rex music more now. You know, the bongos and the...
The Mickey Finn stuff, Steve Tucker.
Fantastic, absolutely fantastic.
But he had a really unusual, I remember Desdemona, I'm thinking, what manner of beast is he singing this?
It's because he's like,
Desdemona, pick up your skirt. Do you seriously think somebody's going to give you a good, you know, kiss, or you ever get sex singing like that?
It's
mad, but wonderful.
Great. Yeah, I do love bongos. They're fantastic.
And you were working as a postman, weren't you, for a while?
31 years.
31 years?
Yeah.
All right, so when was that? What it was sort of like?
1986 is when I joined.
All right.
Until I was 60, it's the 60th birthday when I retired.
So what was it, you just wanted to be a postman?
I'd always wanted. I mean, my uncle that was a Chelsea fan, he was a postman for the start. He was a postman in Bond Street. And then he was a postman on the travelling post office around about the time of the great train robbery. He was doing it at that point, you know, sorting on the way to Scotland and all that. Yeah, and he just taught me all about the geographic areas of Scotland and all that. And I was only, I don't think I was even at primary school. So I was always into geography. And that's probably the other thing is...
So would you be out with a bag then? You'd be out sort of doing the street?
But the other thing is, when we started Subway Sec, we had our image was like being all great. So we used to go down Oxfam shops and get clothes and just dye them grey. So then...
Yeah, because grey's a wonderful...
And then, in those days, postmen were all grey as well.
No, it's a great look. It's a great look. Yeah. You know, I mean, it's whatever, Joy Division, whatever.
Yeah.
It's a lovely kind of... There's something almost military about
it. We did it because it's cool. The Clash had, at that point, the early Clash, they didn't have all that combat gear. The first incarnation, they just had all the Jackson Pollock paintball, really bright coloured clothes that have been had paint spattered all over them. Like, it's actually been adopted. The underground trains actually have a similar thing on their floors. So, quite a few things that the Clash did, funnily enough, well, it's more Bernie Rhodes, he was the one who did all the design for
them. Oh, right.
Have actually passed into, it's like the combat gear, like post office men now have combat shorts and combat trousers.
Yeah, there's a lot of them in shorts.
Yeah,
there seems to be a thing about postmen being out in the middle of winter, showing off the knees and stuff.
Doing his first Clash stuff because he actually employed a woman to sew all the stuff above the studio. That was where all the clothes were made. And I think it was in 1978, they had as a customer for a combat jacket and trousers. It's another artist on, because it was the link was CBS signed the Clash, didn't they? Well, Dylan actually had a Clash
Dylan.
Suit made. Yeah.
Wow.
So I wrote a song about it. I never actually put it out. It's called Dylan in Clash Trousers. As soon as I heard about it, I thought, oh, I've got to write a song about that.
Yeah.
But it runs nicely.
Dylan in Clash Trousers. It's got a lovely kind of onomatopoeia to run. Yeah.
But the thing is, that now is what you get in the high street. You go into any of these high street chains.
Yeah. It's been adopted. Yeah, it's been adopted.
It's a thing, and the same with a throwing paint or like that. They flick the paint in all the different colours onto like the ties and the shirts and even the amps.
Mm-hmm.
With about five or six different bright colours. Well, that has been adopted as a sort of wallpaper look now.
Yeah.
Or a flooring look.
Well,
it's like sex was a bit out there, wasn't it? You know what I mean? Sex, all the bondage gear, that hasn't really filtered into the high street. Can't imagine people going to Next and getting a load of bondage.
Well, there's Anne Summers, which is. So, was that your first time at Port Elliot last?
I don't normally do festivals. I'll tell you all the festivals I've ever done in my life. There's probably less than half a dozen. I've done Latitude.
Yeah.
Keith Allen's stage. That's how we got it, because we did it.
Oh, yeah, we played there last year.
Yeah.
He books us regularly, Keith.
What else?
Because I'm talking to him as well. I'm going to have a chat with him.
Oh, right, good.
We're going to do a little pod.
I
did David Payne a couple of nights ago from the Blockheads.
Oh, right.
You know, the sax player.
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah. But, so I've got Keith Allen coming up.
So I've done Latitude because of Keith Allen. That was an amazing night because it was a monsoon and we were in a big marquee. And there was so much water on the roof that it was getting really dangerous. So Keith Allen had to go on the stage and say, look, this is halfway through our set. We're going to have to cancel this gig unless you all put your hands up on the ceiling and get rid of all the water that's on this roof. So we had about a 15-minute intermission while everyone
was brushing the water off.
Yeah.
So when was this? When did you play?
Oh, must be about... I'll never forget driving into the site because Daryl Hall and John Oates were on. They were doing one of my favourite songs. Oh, I could hear it really clearly. I thought, it sounds great. But must have been about 8 years ago, probably.
Yeah.
But it was horrible weather. I mean, it was like this monsoon came down and the site became like a mud bath. And we were... Keith Allen kept saying, oh, don't go home, lads. I've got you a... something or other to stay in. And we just looked at the state of the mud and I thought, no, I just want to get out of this because it's going to get worse. And it was pissing down with rain. when I got home, that similar thing happened to me at Reading. I did Reading in the early 90s with Edwin. But I was only doing backing stuff for him, but I did do Stop That Girl with Suggs got up. I was singing Stop That Girl with the country group. Trying to think of their name now. Rocking Birds. Remember the Rocking Birds? Country Fire. Well, they did a version of Stop That Girl and they wanted me to sing it with them at Reading because Edwin was playing there. And so I did that, but what I didn't know is Suggs got up and started singing it with me. He was pissed out of his head. Afterwards, he said, "Oh, great song, mate, great song." So I did Reading, I did Tea in the Park in Glasgow with Edwin again. So I was like mainly playing guitar and backing vocals for Edwin, but did a few of my own numbers in his, in his set. And one song we did, it's really freezing, it's really hard to play when it's absolutely freezing, but your hands sort of freeze up on the guitar. It was on Glasgow Green, about 92 or 93. We did The Killing of Georgie by Rod Stewart. So I had to do all the high backing vocal. Do, 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 do.
Excellent.
So, Red in Tea in the Park, Latitude, Paul Elliott.
That's it.
I'm done any other festivals. Yeah. Because I tend to do just gigs. I don't do tours either. I mean, obviously, I used to do tours, but I can only really get away for a couple of days at once now. I can't piss off for ages.
Because it's because of your dad, is it? Yeah, because you're watching your dad.
My dad come when I do go away for a couple of days. My sister comes round and sleeps here.
Yeah,
but I couldn't go off for like a week or do these tours or anything like that. So I haven't done any of that since last tour I did was promoting Songs for Sale in 1982 with the group that I've got now. Funnily enough.
Right. Yeah.
But they're all the same. I mean, they're not in a position to bugger off on long tours because, like, Sean's got his art gallery, right? He can't just go and leave that. Johnny Britton is Johnny Britton, the guitar, he don't go outside King's Cross, let alone go on tour. And Chris, my bass player, he's sort of family man. I can't see him leaving his boy and his wife. And also his wife has got a dog walking business that they run from home. So
he's chained to that then.
Yeah. So we're all in the same boat. Like a lot of people of our age, we can't really do that touring. It's just a case of one-off gigs, really, or two in a row, or three in a row.
You're not going somewhere like Belgium or to...
We'd go to Belgium to do one gig.
And then fly back.
I mean, if there weren't a virus. We often do that. Yeah, we get loads of gigs like that in Europe, just come out and do one or two. Like Hamburg, we've done like two in a row and then come home. Rome, we've done Bologna, like that. Yeah, they're all in isolation. We've done Galicia, who are the people who want us to go back next May. We've played in Galicia twice. I've played in Barcelona about 10 times, and I've done a record out there in a place called Vic, which is 100 kilometres from Barcelona. Yeah. I did
with somebody, some mates, Massa Mates. Mates.
So I went out there and they did a documentary about me going out there, which I actually got, but it's the last reel is missing because the bloke who directed it, his job was doing all the films for Barcelona Football Club. So he was doing my film and he was doing the editing in the Barcelona editing place, but then he lost his job before he'd done the last reel. So he's given us what he's done, which is about 40 minutes worth, but the last 20 minutes is me and Matas doing a gig in one of those squares in Barcelona, and you can't really have the film with that because it's all leading up to that. So I've been trying to get that.
So what's this band like? What's Matus like? Yeah,
really
what's,
good.
What kind of music?
Oh, so I mean, what, Spanish, you know.
Do you sing in Spanish? Do you speak Spanish?
No, they don't. But no, they sung in Catalan, Spanish. Okay. Yeah, I did a song with them in Catalan on the EP. Mm. I did one song. See, when they asked me to go out there, it was the bloke who ran their record label. He said, you can either do it two ways. You can either write a song and send it to them and they'll learn it. Or we can, you can come out here and work with them and try and write the songs here. So that's what we did. I said, no, I'd much rather do that. So but they couldn't speak English. That's the thing. It's really hard. I said, I just made them understand. Look, just play me a few riffs that you've got, you know, because they said they had bits that they'd been working on. I said, you'll play us some of them.
And I'll stick some words around them.
Yeah, so I just arranged it. I said, right, I'll have that riff. I want eight of them. And then I want you to go into that other riff for a few. And then I want you to come back to your original riff. And then the third riff, I said, we'll have that in the middle. And then I got them to keep playing it. And I went out there. It was in this fantastic farmhouse in the middle of nowhere, in a barn where we were recording and rehearsing. So I left them in the barn, but I went outside on the table where you could actually hear them, but you're out in the sun.
Yeah.
And like wrote it out there in bits, and that, as I wrote bits, I'd come in and try them. And they're filming all this. That's all on the documentary. It's great, really good.
So, do you read music then?
No, I don't read. Or
so, how do you write something down for? Oh, you just say, I like that.
I'll have that riff for like eight bars, then I'll have that other riff.
Okay, yeah.
I did it like that, and it was, the song was called "Oh, All Right, Go On Then." That was the title.
Great title.
It was really good because the thing is, because they're Catalan, they're not pronouncing it. All they had to do was the chorus. We said, all right, go on. Then, they weren't pronouncing the go. I said, look.
Because it's a G, isn't it?
Yeah, I said, look, pronounce. Instead of saying go on then, say go on then. And they could do that. So you got these Catalan, all right. Go on then. Oh, Mark Riley loved it. The other thing we did, before I went out there, Mark Riley, who I'd done sessions for every year, he said, is there any way you could do me a jingle? Well, in those days, I wasn't connected with anyone who had a studio. I couldn't very well, Edwin had let me use his place, but I couldn't very well say, can I have your engineer there? I need to do a jingle for Mark Riley, you know. Well, maybe I could have done, but I didn't feel able to, you know. So as soon as they asked me to do this record in Catalonia, I said to them, yeah, but I need to do a radio jingle. That's the deal. If you let me do me radio jingle, I'll do your EP for it. So that's what we did. We did three songs and we did it, and the jingle, I didn't know what to do. What happened was, me and my group, we were doing a gig and they were supporting us in Vic. We did two gigs, one in Vic and one in Barcelona with Matez on first and then us.
Yeah.
So I was with my bass player watching Matez set, and they had this song, really great song, but it had this great little bit in the middle. And I sent my bass player, fucking hell.
That's the jingle.
I said, sing Mark Riley at the end of that bit with me. And so we rehearsed it in their set. It's going, da, da. It's like a trombone goes, boom, 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 da, da, boom, boom. Da, na, 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 na.
Mark Riley.
I said, when they do the clap, just say Mark Riley. So, and it worked. So when we come to do recording the jingle, I didn't say Mark Riley. I got all the Catalans, there was about 10 of them, all their mates were there. They were the only ones who shouted Mark Riley. That's what gives it a special thing, because you can tell they're not English. You know?
No idea what they're singing.
He still plays the jingle now and again. Now, it's only a short thing. It's got a little trumpeter. Mark Riley. That's the way they say it. Mark Riley.
Excellent.
I love radio jingles. That's fucking brilliant things to do there.
There's a little app that I used to go see at at Glastonbury called Chorley FM, and it was like a little kind of spoof radio station, and they had a caravan, and they were just two northern. There's a big guy who's about 6'3", and he used to wear like cutaway denim shorts. Big guy, beard, hair, looked like a geography teacher, and he had cowboy boots on. And his partner was very small, and she'd be in like kind of a latex suit. And they used to do Groovies in the Heart, and they'd be sort of doing this dance routine. And then they start talking about Jehovah's Witnesses and stuff. And they'd do like, they had little competitions and stuff, and they'd play really suspect songs and talk a lot about, you know, suspect topics and stuff. Yeah. And the kids would be there. And it was very borderline, but really electric, and they're called Chorley FM. I think it's Chorley.
I love radio.
Bramble FM. Bramble.
Oh, right. That's it, yeah. It's really good, though, isn't it? Radio.
Radio,
generally.
Yeah.
It's a lot better than television. Yeah. I think.
Well, it just gives you space to, you can sit and just scratch your chin and and it just filters in. It's not kind of doesn't punch you in the face.
You know? The fact that you can go from like, I'm really into Tony Blackburn and his soul show.
All right.
I love that. And then you can get like someone like Mark Riley.
So where's is he on like?
He's on Radio London on Sunday lunchtime. Okay. Well, they've moved him because of the virus. They've put him on at night now, and it's not so soul-y, but he used to have like a lunchtime thing every Sunday, do the old soul classics, and he'd get people ringing in, and he don't care what he says to people. You know, he's really insulting to someone. But then I love like Punjabi music. I love that beat, you know. So anything like that, I love listening to the Punjabi Hit Squad show. And then you got, I really like old Trevor Nelson soul show. Because I used to be mad on this thing called Choice FM, but it went out of existence about 10 or more years ago. It was a great station, only in London. It was just mainly R&B, you know, more modern. They had a few, they did reggae at night, and but in the day it was all sort of R&B, soul and R&B. Fantastic station. Really miss that. But yeah, and I like the old dancehall as well in the 90s. I was heavily into that because... Yeah. I used to, on Choice FM, they used to do the dancehall top 30, you know, run down like chart with all the new entries and all that. So I used to tape it, and then I used to go and buy the ones that I really liked, you know. There was so much stuff coming out in the 90s, you couldn't bloody keep up with it. Because in the 90s, I had a really good job. I was the transport manager at a post office. I was a manager then. Because I started off as a postman. I got promoted to a postman higher grade after about a year. And then I was in the transport department, and the boss got a job in insurance, and he didn't tell his boss, so they were one short. So he came up to me and said, "Do you want to be a transport manager?" I never thought of being a manager. I said, "I can't drive." He said, "Oh, don't worry about that. We'll put you through your test and all that." So I thought, it's all right.
So you learnt to drive as well?
They taught me how to drive, and going up to like 750, they started off in a car, then in a small van, then in a bigger van, then they got bigger and bigger.
So you're bigger. Doing like Arctic?
Not drive. Arctic, no. the biggest one that isn't an Arctic to do the Arctic thing, it costs you $2,000, even in those days. It was like a major expense.
That's a handy thing to get.
But I tell you what, the post office, when I was there, they used to actually sponsor people if they wanted to, because they didn't need Arctic drivers, because it cost so much, no one could afford to take it. They used to pay them, they used to pay for them to do it, and then deduct it out of their wages, like £50 a week or whatever.
Yeah.
So it was good in those days. It was so different than now. I mean, you used to get cleaning tokens with your wages in those days, things like that, you know, luncheon vouchers and a subsidised canteen, all those things.
Yeah.
You can't imagine any of that now, can you?
Because I imagine that sort of you have a certain sort of, it's like you have to sort of, you have a certain amount of time to do a run now, haven't you, as a postman?
Yeah.
You know, they have like kind of the clocking here, like a tachometer or something.
Nightmare.
You know, you only go to the toilet, you have to toilet break. You're allowed one toilet break every 90 minutes or something. And it's a bit...
It's a nightmare now.
Yeah. I used to do Christmas casual, you know, I did it a few years. That was nice.
Yeah, because it's only
just handling mail. And I got, and the money was good. And I do like a few nights and when I was...
No, it was a great job in the 80s. Yeah. It's really good.
Aye. I'm just looking. I've got something down here. I've got one step from the gutter, baby.
Yeah.
Is that a real fear?
What do you mean?
Well, I just there's that line, one step from the gutter.
Yeah.
Are you sort of? Is that something that you sort of you thought about when you were younger? That sort of you were like one step from the street.
Yeah. No, it says I only feel safe when I'm one step away from the gutter. I get that.
Yeah, there's a sort of a.
I was always messing about in gutters though. As a kid, I got scarlet fever when I was about 6 years old, which was like a killer disease in those days, and that's how I got it. I used to play about. I was fascinated by drains. And they didn't know how I got it, but as soon as the doctor sort of asked me, Mum, where does he play and all that, I used to play in gutters, you know, as a little kid outside my door.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Don't know why. Fuck knows why.
I had a brother who used to drink puddles.
Do that, but I was just fascinated by, you know, all the water going down the drain, I suppose.
Yeah. That resonated with me because I've lived my life for the last whatever 40 years or so, and I've never had a kind of a proper job. I've lived off my wits.
Yeah.
I was on the dole for a while, and it nearly broke me, and I nearly had a breakdown because I lost all the kind of oomph, and I'd be getting up at 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon and stuff. I'm thinking, this is going to kill me. I said, please God, don't let me die. I just said a prayer, and the next thing I was selling ties in the shopping centre in Leeds.
Oh, right.
I just thought, I got an ironing board out and stuck it in the middle of Merrion Centre in Leeds. Laid out all these ties and says, come on, ladies, 2 for a pound here. Look, 100% zircon. He'll look lovely in that one there. And I started to make money. Okay. I'm thinking, but I've been to art college.
Yeah.
I'm a salesman now. I've descended to this. And then I was selling second-hand paperbacks. But then at 27, I drew somebody in Biro, and a friend of mine in pen, in one go. And I'm thinking, shit, I've drawn somebody in pen.
Yeah.
And no guidelines or anything, and it looks like them.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, I'm an artist. Yeah. I'm a portrait artist.
Yeah.
Thank God, I've got my moniker now. I've got my little badge, portrait artist. I know what I am.
Yeah.
And I know that. And somebody said, you'll never starve. And that to me was like, that's a great thing to tell somebody because you think I'll always eat because I've got a gift because I can sing for my supper. But there's always been the threat that. You know, I was in London in the early 80s when I first started drawing. I was doing these portraits on paper bags. I'd seen some bags in a bread shop in Ireland, and I just thought they were lovely.
Yeah.
They just sang to me, and I thought, wouldn't that be lovely to draw on that bag? Wouldn't it be lovely to sell that bag to somebody? So somebody, I'd give them a bag, they could have their own bag.
Yeah.
Could I sell a paper bag to somebody? I thought, yes.
Yeah.
And I got a pile and just went in the pub in Longford in Ireland. And there's a big fella at the bar, and I said, I do portraits on paper bags.
Yeah.
Would you like your own personal paper bag?
Yeah.
And he said, yes.
Oh, great.
I drew him, and he paid me, and I thought, I felt like Picasso.
Yeah.
I thought, I've followed a whim.
Yeah.
and I skipped in the street. I said, I thought, I'm going to bag the world. I'm just going to bag, and I did it for like 30 years.
Yeah.
But it was always very precarious, and there was always a thought that, well, if I don't, some days I'd come home and I hadn't sold a drawing. And then another day, and then there'd be 2 days gone, I'm thinking, oh shit, I wish I was a postman.
Yeah.
Or I wish I had a job in Tesco, because at least I'll eat, you know. But I thought, no, I must stick this out.
Yeah.
So I've kind of had 30 years of just hanging on.
Yeah.
And always thinking that And I see people around me on the street, and I just think, you know, I'm them.
Yeah.
And they're me.
Yeah.
So, and I don't understand why other people don't see them, because I think, well, you could be there. Just because you've got a big house and you've got a... You could be there next week if your missus kicks you out because she finds out about who you're sleeping with or whatever.
Yeah.
You could be on that, you know, and so just think again and just acknowledge the person at least.
Yeah.
You know, so, but that kind of stuff, I think some of your words are very potent.
Yeah,
and I
think that came from the post as well. Like being on rounds, you are literally one step from the car, aren't you? Every day.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's been lovely talking to you, Vic. It's
have a cup of tea.
I'd like another cup of tea. I would.
Sun's out.
I would, and.
I'll show you me latest.
Oh yeah, I want to talk about your fag pack. I want to talk about your painting as well. All right, good. We're just having a break now for 10 minutes while Vic makes me a cup of tea. Running. Hello again. Anyway, here we are. There's Vic here, and there's Mandy here, and there's Harry in the kitchen, and there's a cat.
So that's Laszlo.
Laszlo.
And there's another one in the bushes.
That's Jussi. He's named after the opera singer Jussi Björling.
All right. Don't know. Anyway, Vic, we're going to just. I've just brought my book out. It's straight hot off the press, and I think there's a mention of you in the introduction somewhere. Oh, here we are. Blah-de-blah-de-blah-de-blah. You're in here somewhere. But anyway.
I'll find it.
So I brought it all the way down from Leeds. And you've got something. So what's
I've got a new single.
Got a new single.
On the label, Gnu Inc, that I run with Mandy and Andrew Shaw. Does the website up in Manchester, and it's by James Dunn, who used to be my manager in the 90s, and he used to run Motion Records along with Mike Coe, who does all the mastering for me. So it's his first group recorded a song at Hope and Anchor in 1979 using a drum machine, and he didn't know that he still had the tape, so when he recently found it, Mike Coe's remastered it, and it sounds great. It just sounds like early Joy Division, Self-Control.
What was his band called?
Self-Control.
Yeah.
And it's a vinyl.
It sounds like a Joy Division album.
Yeah.
Self-Control.
Well, so it's a bit ahead of its time, that is.
Now, with all our guests, Vic, do you have a recommended album of the week, or is...
Yeah, my new album. It's not of the week. It's coming out in November. And Moments Like These. Text Untone is the name of the company that's putting it out.
Excellent. Right, well, thank you very much for your time, Vic Goddard. And thank you for the tea as well, Mandy.
Anytime you're in London, Mick, come round and you can have a cup of tea round here.
And thanks for coming on the Ego Pod, Vic, and thanks to you listeners for tuning in. You can listen to this again.
Yeah, Mick, next time we get the table tennis table out.
Oh, we get the table. There's a table tennis table which will be involved possibly even today. Okay, thank you, Vic Goddard, for coming on the Ego Podcast, and thanks to you listeners for tuning in. Vic Goddard's new album, Moments Like These, is due out shortly on the Text and Tone label. Further details can be found at the website vicgoddard.co.uk, Twitter @Vic_Goddard, Facebook Vic Goddard.
You can listen to this again and download this podcast on iTunes, Mick Artistic's Ego Podcast. Further links can be found on our website, mickartistic.com. See you on the road and on the waves next time. Bye.